Who doesn't love a good stick figure drawing? But they don't exactly shout, "I'm a professional therapist," do they? See what professional exercise prescription software looks like with a 3-month free trial on us. Discover how easy it is to fully customize patients' rehabilitation plans whilst choosing from hundreds of exercise pictures and videos, each with modifiable descriptions. You can even send them out by email or WhatsApp. Plus, you get inbuilt virtual consultation software as standard. Claim your free trial now at rehabmypatient.com/physiomatters.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jack Chu. This is Chewing It Over, Mondays and Thursdays, 12:30 till 1 o'clock. We chat about whatever is top in MSK practice, usually where it intersects with culture, especially pop culture, like Tom Jessen and Rob Tyer coming out with a book. I think that's the sort of breakthrough thing for MSK that's going to light the touch paper on the world media. And so I'm just delighted to get in first and talk to my mates and get some signatures. Rob's unfortunately not available today, so we'll have to sort of scrape along with just Tom Jessen. But as you have enjoyed before, his episodes are always a treat. He's been, for those that don't know, the Cytica book last year that really did change. I think it really changed people's minds as to how content could be consumed and created. Myself included, we've done various different long and short form audio, video courses, etc. But Tom felt like the first in a long time to really get stuck into this in proper deep dive project format, and that was in Cytica, and it's great for him to then lend himself to what is a really interesting and contentious area of practice, which we'll get stuck into in a second, of course, with Corda Aquina. Let me click all the buttons. Right, let's get rid of my screen and bring you Tom Jessen. Oh, look at him reading. Oh,
hey, sorry, Jack. To interrupt. Sorry. Jack, I was just reading this really absorbing book about Corda Aquina syndrome.
Quite the page turner.
Of Sciatica, the Clinician's Guide.
You think that's cheesy? Check that out on the bottom, look. It's as if we planned it. We didn't actually. Tom had that cheesy little prop that he thought he'd use. We didn't talk about it, and I've already got my version of that, which is this little ticker at the bottom, which is a new feature that I had to use. But yeah, I'll move that for now because that's going to put me off. Welcome back. You've been on the show a couple of times. I have to start with why this book, why this topic? You mentioned on this show and elsewhere that when you it was never going to be your only foray into being an author when you did Sciatica, but it surprised me and many that you chose this subject. So can you talk me through how that came about first?
Well, I think, as I remember it, after I did the first Sciatica one, I thought, well, I'll do another one. That was good. But as I remember it, I didn't really want to tackle book two because it's quite a lonely job, or it was quite a lonely job doing book one by myself, especially over here in America. I just felt like quite isolated. So sure. I thought, well, I'll do something with someone. And the first person I thought of was Rob. I think originally we were wanting to do something on red flags or serious pathology, which is an interest of Rob's. And then, I think over time we realized that's such a huge topic. You can't really do that well. We need to be a bit more specific. And we just ended up on Corda Aquina syndrome because that's kind of overlaps with my interest in sort of nerve root stuff, and Rob's interest is, like, in particular, Corda Aquina stuff is something that he's really keen on. So we just thought we'd be able to do a really good job of it. Hopefully people are interested, we'll see. It's done pretty well so far. And as you say, it is a contentious topic. It was basically just a combination of both our interests and some suspicion that people would find it useful, because I mean, it's always been a bit of a painful thing for me. Well, for the patients, really, but for me, like cauda equina syndrome is kind of like, I've always had difficulty with that in my practice. So this kind of book was an opportunity for Rob, who he's not here, so we can say he's the expert. I'm sure he'd deny that, but he's kind of really the clinical nitty gritty stuff, for me to work with him and kind of make essentially the book that I wanted to read in my first sort of 2 or 3 years of practice to get me out of all the CES struggles I was having.
It's quite a quagmire, though, isn't it? You see, one of the reasons I was surprised is because the reason it's a contentious topic is because it's something that is, no one denies its importance. No one denies it's something that we need to be aware of, act swiftly on. But it's been in recent years something that has then meant that people have had massively different takes on the actions to be taken in such a way that then it just, you know, most people would have steered clear of that. So between the two of you, you fancied the challenge and you saw you'd have the expertise, not just to understand the subject matter, but also get that down in a format that was going to be palatable. Because you are here, not that Rob stood us up, it was a late notice plan, but you are, if you were to be expert in one thing right now, and you're expert in many, but one thing is, you know what happens to nerves when they get pressed on. Is that all right for me to say, right? So you wrote something fairly thorough in that regard with regards to sciatica. Not that that's the only thing that can cause those symptoms, let's say, but you know what happens there. So this is a bit of an extension of that to some extent, and where it becomes then serious. So can we start there in the clinical and say, what is cauda equina? And what isn't it as well?
So I'm hesitating because I feel like most viewers will know the answer to this, but I've written a book about sciatica, as you know, and sciatica, if you put it in really simple terms, that kind of one-sided nervy leg pain tends to happen when a single lumbar nerve root is compressed or irritated or just pissed off in some way. And that's really, really common. You know, most people will see sciatica of one form or another many times a week. And cauda equina syndrome, as viewers know, is much more rare. Rather than just one kind of lone nerve root being compressed, it's when the whole bundle of nerve roots, lumbosacral nerve roots, is compressed or irritated. The other difference is that rather than just being one nerve root that goes down the legs being irritated, the whole bundle being irritated involves the nerves that go not only to the legs, but to the bladder, bowel, the pelvis, and the sexual organs too. And so for that reason, it's the potential for cauda equina syndrome to really compromise someone's life is even greater than radicular pain, and also why it's an emergency. So that's what cauda equina syndrome is.
And does that vary in terms of level then? So that's one of the things that when people, you know, how concerned should people be? Because we often ask red flag screening questions, cauda equina screening questions, particularly when someone does present with back and leg pain. The logic I've always understood it to be is that the presence of what might well be, say, a disc or other space occupying lesion, then creating pressure or potential pressure irritation, let's say, on that nerve root, means that then an extension of that or a development of that means that they need to be more in touch with that than Joe Bloggs, who might not have pain or that sort of issue. Is that something that matters much as to level specificity, and how much does that vary between people?
You mean the level of compression clinically?
Yes. Yeah.
I think this is a funny one because I think in terms of our practices, I'm assuming most people listen to musculoskeletal practitioners, physios, osteopaths, and, you know, I think understanding your question correctly, it's not that important whether they're thinking, oh, is this an L3, L4, L5 compression.
I was meaning that, but I was meaning like segmental level rather than extent of, if that's what you're wondering with regards to the language. So yeah, I was just meaning like, does the location matter? Because some people would be complacent over it being, I have heard that before where some people have been like, this doesn't indicate this particular region or level or what have you, as to whether or not they'd be concerned. So that's kind of what's fueling my question.
Mm-hmm. I think the there's a kind of point where we have to say we probably shouldn't think about that too much. If anything, that might be a bit misleading. It's certainly not a consideration that we think of in the book, is that we're thinking much more about, to one way of putting it is our, it's not our job to diagnose cord recliner syndrome as a physio and osteopath, unless you work in a really specialist setting. So we're not really, when we see a patient in the typical outpatient setting, we're certainly not diagnosing cord recliner syndrome, because most people would agree you need an MRI scan to do that. And we're not even really, you know, making a clinical diagnosis of cord recliner syndrome. We're trying to say, does this person's clinical picture look like it could be? Do they need to be seeing someone else as a matter of emergency or urgency, and not me? So I certainly wouldn't worry clinically too much about kind of levels of compression and that kind of stuff. What we're going for in the book is much more about building up that clinical picture with the patient and saying, does this look like cord recliner syndrome? It's not my job to say if it is or not, is or isn't at the end of the day. But if it looks like it to me, then I need to do something, and usually pretty quickly too.
I woke up this morning genuinely torn as to whether or not to use the phrase index of suspicion on this podcast today, Tom, as I know it triggers you. So I won't. But what? Tell me about the profile of patient, or a classic sort of presentation that we would need to understand, and then we can get stuck in if we can, about the signs, symptoms, and sort of likelihood ratios even of as to what would indicate an emergency in this instance.
Mm-hmm. So the classic picture of a case of cord recliner syndrome is the, and I'm hesitating because it's almost like in the book, we actually want to help people with stuff that isn't the classic, you know, because I think most people are quite comfortable with someone who turns up and they said, last week I bent down, I felt something go in my back. A few hours later, I felt the pain go down my leg. It's really, really bad. Now the other leg's getting involved. And as a clinician, you're thinking, shit, bilateral sciatica. And straight away, that usually would make you think that something is compressing the whole bundle of nerve roots on both sides rather than just the one nerve root. Bilateral sciatica. And then typically, and you know, this is the right place to be talking about ifs, buts, and maybes. There's so many ifs, buts, and maybes, but typically then people might first start to describe some problems with their bladder habits. The bladder is much smaller than the bowel. You use it much more often. So if the bowel is, there's a problem with the bowel, you often don't notice that for a day or two. If there's a problem with the bladder, you might notice that much sooner, because you go for a wee many times a day. And it might start off with something like a little bit of hesitation when urinating, finding that they have to, you know, wait 30 seconds or so to get going. They can't feel it when they're urinating. And maybe they're sitting on the toilet. They don't know they're urinating except that they can hear themselves going. And then over time, that bladder problem will progress to urinating less and less. They'll go into retention. And eventually they'll retain so much that they start to overflow, like this dribbling overflow incontinence from the bladder. And of course, as viewers know as well, there's loss of sensation in the saddle area, which in general also tends to be a fairly early symptom. And then, as I say, emphasis on the in general, the bowel problems tend to come a little bit later. Similar to the bladder, at the end of the day, you get retention, the bowel just switches off. Because, you know, there's no innervation through the cord recliner, but earlier on, you might get more subtle signs. It's like a loss of anal tone, which might manifest as someone having to wipe an awful lot, for example, after they go, and just a general lack of a sense of what they call it, like rectal fullness. So, oh, I don't really feel like I need to go to the toilet. I haven't been going. I don't feel like I need to. So there's a difference there with constipation. So like that's the classic picture. of like bilateral radicular pain with bladder sensory symptoms, maybe progressing to bowel symptoms, and loss of sexual function as well. The difficulty, of course, really comes when we're in the gray areas. So maybe someone might have very subtle symptoms because they're quite early. Like I mentioned, the hesitation when urinating, the loss of sensation. Like, how do you tease that apart from just the general problems that lots of people have when urinating? And then kind of like ambiguous, unusual presentations as well. So, you know, what do you do if someone has a recent onset of acute radicular pain, but also a loss of sexual function? So they found that they can't get an erection, or they don't get an erection in the morning and they used to. That's really difficult to tease out because it's not a classic picture, but a loss of sexual function is a red flag for Cordwell Quine syndrome. I've kind of rambled in answer to your question.
No. You've rightly, I mean, you're only talking about the typical case, but it just felt smart for us to go there. And before we then descend into potentially unpacking different, say, case scenarios, or we could create hypotheticals, let's just break down how good an indicator each of these things might be. So, for example, we often even say, it's become so habitual, isn't it? And it changes your bladder or bowel function, or we might then, but then it's the learning to interrogate those more carefully, which we've done. You know, we've done podcasts with PhysioMatters, and there's various other material out there that helps us to differentiate that more carefully. But let's say urinary retention, let's say fecal incontinence, let's say sexual function, let's say saddle anesthesia and what we might mean by that, or generally sort of perineal sensation. Which of those, if any, are more or less reliable in a typical case for what then they've been said and done, and then an MRI has confirmed a urgent Cordwell Quine case that needs a decompression? What do we know of that in the literature?
Well, Jack, it's a familiar story, is that we don't know all that much, really. So this is the interesting thing, and it leads to debate about red flags in general. Like, as you know, if you are a pure empiricist and you really want the evidence to kind of give you permission to do anything, then the evidence for the so-called red flags for Cordwell Quine syndrome is very, very poor. There's poor kind of specificity and sensitivity for the classic red flags. So like a really recent study by Michelle Angus, a big study, really interesting, fantastic study, found what you really might expect, actually, which is that any kind of bladder dysfunction is almost equally common in people who do and don't have Cordwell Quine syndrome, who are referred into an emergency setting. And there are some things in the study that did have a good kind of likelihood ratio. So a bilateral kind of loss of ankle reflex was an interesting one that I picked up on. There was some kind of signal in the data that was like associated with people having Cordwell Quine syndrome MRI on the MRI, like a compression of the Cordwell Quine as compared to people who don't. But in terms of what we think of as kind of the classic evidence-based kind of evidence behind red flags, if you're looking for sensitivity and specificity, it's really quite poor. And that's really one of the problems we wanted to try and get around in the book, because there's a kind of, maybe controversy is too strong a word, but you're hearing a lot of people these days say, the evidence for red flags is poor, therefore we shouldn't use them. We should kind of forget about them. They're useless. And we don't believe that at all. We wanted to reframe red flags from being special tests, which they're not. So some people are using special tests, right? Okay, if you do a Lachman's test and it's positive, then there's an ACL tear. If someone has bladder dysfunction, then they have a serious pathology. There's two totally different things. We think of red flags not as special tests, but as conversation starters. So you're talking to your patient and they say, yeah, now that you mention it, I haven't been urinating as much. That's not really a positive or a negative on a test in our mind. So to your question, we don't really feel like that's something that the evidence can tell us a lot about bladder dysfunction, cauda equina syndrome. You can't really expect those two things to be related in any way. Both things, one thing is unbelievably common, one thing is unbelievably rare. So we're thinking of these things, bladder dysfunction, saddle, bowel, sexual dysfunction, as conversation starters much more than as yes or no special tests.
Well, if someone's straining to pass urine, then this is often someone that's presenting to you because they're in pain. You had to ask them, are you straining to pass urine because, you know, for some reason it hurts to tense up, or particularly even more so when opening the bowels. That's a difficult thing to sort of try and tease out. Similarly, the masquerading variables with someone with prostate issues for whether they're straining to pass urine, but they could still have cauda equina. In fact, you've got a higher risk. Someone's got, you know, some what they thought was stable prostate cancer. Then you want to be particularly bothered about whether a space occupying mass is then actually causing cauda equina as well. They can coexist, and so that's why it can't be a yes no. False positives we can make a lot of sense of, but what I'm interested in as well is then, so how many people have cauda equina that then don't have any of the indicators that might have helped us had we have seen them first to then get them investigated? Because I think that's the thing that kind of really does blow that open, doesn't it? Is if it turns out that people present in and then do have cauda equina, and I want to include pain in that as well, if you don't mind. I want to sort of try and work out as to how many of these cauda equina cases have the classic bilateral pain or even any sciatica at all into one leg.
Well, pain is very common, so the evidence is really interesting. It's reasonably varied, but almost everyone has some kind of back pain. There seems to be like a, I can't remember exactly, it's between 2 and 5% don't, but someone's going to have had back pain, and almost everyone has some kind of radicular pain as well. One interesting thing that came, I was very surprised in the evidence, but very consistently, half of people with cauda equina syndrome, in fact, more than half, have a unilateral radicular pain. So straight away there, you've got a problem with the classic picture of bilateral radicular pain. Half of people just have pain in one side. And many of the people with bilateral radicular pain, in fact, have one leg much worse than the other, you know. So straight away, you've got a problem there with the classic picture. And it probably reflects what actually is common sense when you think about it, which is, there's no reason for a disc herniation to be symmetrical, right? It's probably going to touch one side more than the other. And then we know pain is really weird, and maybe someone might have bilateral compression, but unilateral symptoms. So that doesn't mean that bilateral radicular pain shouldn't be particularly concerning, right? Because it's so rare. Mm-hmm. But amongst people with cauda equina syndrome, probably more than half have unilateral symptoms.
And this is something that, especially in, I'm going to get through your book, and I know that I'm going to be so tempted to finally hurry along a podcast I've been meaning to do with my dad for years about his experience with cauda equina, which I'm sure I will have mentioned to you before, you might have heard me say, but I know that he had an episode of serious pain, but it was actually by the time he ended up having any sort of symptoms that then made it an emergency, he actually didn't have any pain. He ran into work that day, and when drying himself, noticed that it was a bit numb in his nether regions and started to get tingling where he didn't want it, rang me up and said, is this what you've been asking me those weird personal questions for? And that is one of those things that makes me then, I can't help but intersect this with our best understanding of pain. Is that, you know, all of the circumstances of recovery from what was a ridiculous pain and you know, fairly broad-based, you know, you would have assumed it to be a broad-based disc bulge, but his recovery had been typical for what you might have had from him better understanding his problem and managing it carefully and stuff. And so that's why pain's not always a good indicator, but it does sound like it's a rare thing for people to have not had pain, whether they actively do at the time of any assessment. So that's interesting. What about the other retention, sexual function, those sorts of signs with regards to, say, false negatives and stuff? Are these things sometimes pretty much silent to all those other signs?
So I guess the thing to say is that it might be obvious, but cauda equina syndrome, you're going to need one of those kind of four things by definition, right? And so you're going to need one of bladder, bowel, saddle, or sexual dysfunction by definition. It's worth as well saying there's no guarantee. You don't need all of them. You don't need a full house. You just need one card. And so by extension, it's perfectly possible that someone could have just one symptom, you know, bladder dysfunction, and have no other symptom of cauda equina syndrome. So they just have, let's say, radicular pain and bladder dysfunction and cauda equina compression on the MRI. That's cauda equina syndrome. And so by extension, they have no bowel symptoms. They have no, in terms of the statistics, it's a little hard to interpret. As I said, saddle dysfunction, you're looking at around 90%, and bladder only slightly less, up at 80%, up at 80s of people with cauda equina syndrome. Bowel dysfunction seems to be a little more rare, and you can't really trust the statistics on sexual dysfunction because, you know, people don't report it and many people don't ask about it, so it's hard to say.
Gotcha. Well, just out of interest though, because you're quite right, is that for them to have cauda equina syndrome, then they need to have these. There's got to be a there. However, on imaging, it could well be that that's a, that for all intents and purposes, uncoupled from the story, there's a concern over what looks to be a broad compressive lesion that you would expect to have disrupted some or all of those things. So I suppose that's why I wonder in terms of the likelihood and validity of those sorts of bits, is that sometimes that is an area where the imaging should really quite, you know, should talk beyond the picture sometimes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm not totally sure I understand, but are you saying that someone might have like cauda equina compression on imaging but not have cauda equina syndrome?
Yeah, so someone's then, I mean, again, it's where a patient can have an MRI for what might be an unresolving radiculopathy. Nervous about my language here with you, of course, but let's just say that they've got then a compressive lesion on that is warranted for an MRI. Or let's say it's not warranted, and this is just someone that's got back pain that they shouldn't have had, but they've paid, or someone's ordered it when it's probably not that indicated by our own rules. But then it surprises you to find on that MRI that is something that you're then asking 101 very in detail questions about whether or not they have any red flags, to find that they don't, but the imaging would be suggestive of something. So it's almost like they're on the cusp and they're somehow managing to have a sort of subclinical cauda equina almost. That's kind of what I'm meaning. Am I talking up a massive bizarre rarity there, or is that something that is feasible? And it is sometimes very, you know, unknown as to why people do or don't have symptoms.
Yeah. So I think it's a reasonably common for people who kind of pick up patients who've had imaging, is that they'll have had imaging for back pain. You know, we know that's not best practice, but it happens. And they have the MRI report comes back and they have cauda equina compression, but no symptoms of cauda equina. They were never referred for cauda equina syndrome. Sometimes I hear people call that radiographic CS. This patient doesn't have cauda equina syndrome. You know, without the symptoms, you can't have the syndrome. They have just a finding on MRI. And, you know, it's a real problem for clinicians, though, because you think, well, is this person a ticking time bomb? What do I need to do? Can I get them doing any exercise? We just recommend that, you know, you call the person, you know, when you get the results, you protect them and yourself by kind of doubling down, asking them these questions again, or for the first time, if it's the first time you're seeing them, have a really good conversation with them, safety net them, you know, make sure they understand exactly what to do if any of the symptoms arise. But at the end of the day, that person doesn't have cauda equina syndrome. So they're not a cauda equina syndrome patient. They're not even depression in most cases.
Your co-authors kindly joined us on the chat. So Rob said a lot of cauda equina compression is found incidentally. Sometimes people then reveal some symptoms that they didn't before, possibly because they didn't see the relevance of the questions until they've been asked more than once by more than one person. Yeah, that is a concern, isn't it? That is where they have a somewhat silent Code of Aquinas syndrome, only silent because they've not mentioned it specifically. He says equally, as Code of Aquinas syndrome is an emerging issue, it could be that you caught them too early. And that's something that can only be teased out by expert questioning, I guess, and how we need to make sure we message, you know, we do delve into that and interrogate it properly. Do you see there is any sort of downside to, I know that very occasionally people will be concerned about if it is held in such high suspicion for so long with these sorts of problems, does that only ramp up and medicalize these things? Is there any, you're obviously in sight of the seriousness on this. And part of me thinks that by doing so, it's likely that you then feel that it is therefore only worthwhile to add more and more layers to questions to make sure that things aren't missed. But then there's part of me that does wonder if, because you and Rob, as thoughtful as you are on the bigger picture, is there any part of you that is concerned that sometimes the avenue will only be back towards what is a bit of regressive medicalization? I wonder if you've reflected on that.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this a lot because it's one of our concerns. Like, how is history going to, I guess anyone in history, 50, 100 years time, but like, how is history going to look? We don't want to write an alarmist book that people are going to look back at and think, oh God, people were really worried about this really rare event in 2022. But it is important to kind of situate it in the history. So when you look at the old papers about Code of Aquinas syndrome, it's only very relatively recently, so in the last sort of 100 years or so, that people have had any idea what it was. In fact, more recently than that, you're looking at sort of the 1950s before people were even using the word Code of Aquinas syndrome.
Right,
and in the 60s, Cyriacus is still saying, oh, we need more people to know about Code of Aquinas syndrome. You look at the papers from 70s, 80s, 90s, and patients are getting picked up, but not till they have what we call like Code of Aquinas syndrome complete. So that, you know, it's far too late. They're at the end of the road. And what we're seeing now, and the book is a very small part of a movement that's been started by, you know, the best and brightest of us well before Rob and I, to raise awareness of Code of Aquinas syndrome so that hopefully we can catch people as those early signs are beginning so that we can get them to surgery, which is when it's effective, because, you know, past a certain point, it is too late. People might not recover. So we are in a period of calibration, and I think in 10, 20, 30 years' time, hopefully we'll have found an equilibrium between over-vigilance and complacency. And it's something we think about a lot in the book. You know, where are we and which side are we, well, how do we find that balance? I think in terms of the individual clinician, you know, there's a lot you can do with your patients to help that balance. And one of the common objections people were saying to us is, if you're going on about this with your patients, you're just going to scare them. You know, you're going to make them more anxious. And we do take that concern like really seriously. Like if you have these in-depth conversations with the patients, you know, just giving them something to worry about. But we're a little bit skeptical that, you know, a conversation or just information about Code of Aquinas syndrome in itself is going to worry patients. And in fact, we could equally argue that information can be reassuring. You know, if you frame it in the right way, if you as a clinician clearly know your shit, if you're calm, confident, if you show them that you know what you're doing, you know what you're talking about, and you give information, you know, you could equally say that this topic of Code of Aquinas syndrome is an opportunity to be reassuring rather than to worry people and medicalize things. So basically our argument is information itself is neither on one side or the other. It doesn't medicalize or demedicalize it. It all depends on how the individual kind of puts it into practice.
Absolutely. Now, just on the serious consequences of, say, missed and mismanaged Code of Aquinas syndromes, I mean, that we definitely are in a situation where we need better systems, better pathways, you know, better methods of creating urgency. I bet that was a difficult thing to write about and cover because of the variation that will exist, not just in the country, but the world over. So how did you tackle that? And what have readers got to look forward to in terms of them having sort of actionable things that they can take back to their services to implement better practice for their communities?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was a really big problem with the book, actually, just in terms of the variation across the world. We've written the book about what we know, which is the UK. And there's a kind of thing on the sales page that says, I don't live in the UK. Is this book for me, in the FAQ? And the answer we give is probably. About 10% of it is very specific to the pathways in the UK. But at the same time, we don't want anyone regretting their purchase. So there's like a refund and stuff. And that sounds like I'm coming out with the sales spiel. But actually, this is what Rob and I talked about. It's like, well, how are we going to do this? We can't talk about the world, but we want people to be able to buy it in different countries. So that's the way we've done it, is if you buy it and it's not for you, we just give you a refund. So that problem is solved. But then, as you say, there's kind of regional variation within the UK. That's difficult when writing a book, because you can't constantly write every single time. Refer to A&E or to the nearest specialist service in spinal orthopedics or spinal neurology, whatever might be the, you know. So in the book, we've done what we what is still the most common method of recourse for acute cauda equina syndrome, which is if someone has new onset symptoms, which is another topic. What does new mean? But if someone has a new onset of symptoms, we say refer to A&E as like a generic thing of what you should do. But in the introduction, we're being very clear to people, you know, we're saying refer to A&E, but consult your local guidelines. You know, talk to your supervisor, because that might not be what it is for you, as will be the case, you know, in some places. But to the point that was always one of the biggest problems for me, is the nitty gritty sort of stuff of, okay, I've got to refer this person to A&E now, or okay, I've got to arrange an urgent scan, but I can't scan now, I have to do that and safety net them. And so there's a whole sort of, the last fifth of the book is actually dedicated to what we think is, you know, really what's missing from textbooks and guidelines and even online courses and stuff, which is, how do you actually do this stuff? How do you refer someone to A&E? What's step one, step two, step three? What if the referral is rejected? You know, what if they are referred but they just bounce straight back? What if they have an MRI but there's nothing on the MRI? What do you do then? So really, the book, what we think of it as being, is it's telling you the stuff that the guidelines aren't, that you won't find in the textbook. How do you actually do all this stuff, you know, on the ground? How do you have that conversation with someone who's embarrassed, or if you're embarrassed? You know, how do you make a decision when it isn't a classic picture? It's kind of this, a bit of this and a bit of that, and you feel on the fence. How do you get off the fence? Because to a great extent, like, the book is about cauda equina syndrome, maybe the first third, but the rest of it is about decision making and navigating the healthcare system with reference to cauda equina syndrome.
Sorry, say again, Tom. I didn't mean to talk over you there.
Just that's what I'm most proud of that we've done with the book, is we've written a book that is not just information about a condition. It's information and advice, and dare I say it, wisdom from Rob about how do you actually do this stuff in clinic.
Yeah, you know? It's one of the things that makes me wonder, although it would have been a fairly tough task, don't get me wrong, but because I know you guys enough to know that it'll be very much about that clinical reasoning, applying it to then decision making and action, and following up on that action, makes me then wonder as to how applicable that logic model that you will no doubt lay out would be to other red flag pathologies, and how that might be, that supplementary guides might be tempting. Have next steps between the two of you been talked about? Are you still friends? Do you still manage to tolerate each other? Are you still putting up with his sci-fi references? Like, how are relations between you as authors?
Jack, it's only brought us closer together. We didn't argue once, I don't think.
Really?
We're both pretty chill guys, and we didn't argue once. And I think we'll definitely do something else together. The totally honest answer is depends how well this does.
So, sure.
Like this yeah. is, it's a bit of a gamble. Do people buy books? I know they sort of do from the sciatica one, but this is a bit more of a niche topic. If this does well, there'll be many more. And if it doesn't, then we'll have to pivot to some sort of paywalls, fix your patient in 7 days. Sort of
cure requirement with this marvelous yeah. medicine. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, well, let's hope you don't have to succumb to that. No, thank you and well done. It's brilliant that you guys are thinking on these subjects for us, and I hope you're appropriately rewarded for it. Obviously, we'll do what we can to sort of get that known about, and you're welcome back on this show for us to delve into it. I know that as I read through it, it's only going to be that I have more questions, and so that's something that we can do, and as I say, possibly get some patient and other experiences in and around the subject matter onto here. For those that haven't noticed it yet, I've got this brilliant little ticker feed at the bottom there. Look, by now, £25. thecesbook.com. And I have also put that in the chat. If you're that lazy, you don't even want to type it into your browser, then go and do it now. One piece of advice that I gave the other day to someone was that you need to just, even if you've not got the time, you're rushing back off, you've got patients in 5 minutes, then open it up on your browser and don't delete that tab until you've made the purchase. You know, we all know it, we get it, you might not have your card with you, whatever, but open it up, have that as a tab on your browser, and then it will remind you to get that sorted before you end up deleting it, because it will be well worthwhile. And I'm hopeful that the success of this book means that then Tom and Rob and all their other contributors can then potentially have a little Mr. Men series. Do you remember them, Tom, where you'd have the spine of the book would then paint a picture? That's yeah. what I'm hoping for, is this sort of Encyclopedia Britannica type version. Look at that. Look, he's showing it off now. That's beautiful. But yeah, well done with it, mate. As I say, I've not read it yet, but certainly we'll be getting stuck into it. Really look forward to it. And we'll see what the future holds with the rest of your books, and whether you probably... One of my biggest fears, though, is that you put off the second side of your book with like, all these different in-betweens, so I'm not going to yeah. let you do that for too much longer, but because I'm really keen to see that next steps, but yeah, well done with it. Hope it's been a fun project, and for those watching on, do make sure you get stuck into it. But for now, bye from us. We'll just wave awkwardly as the captions start. Bye.